Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back with episode number 83 as we continue through our top 100 movies of all time. We're talking about number 18 tonight. For me, that is Wild Tales from 2014. For John, that is Reservoir Dogs from 1992, Quentin Tarantino's directorial debut. We just talked about Tarantino last week. It's funny how we keep doing these in the wrong order. We had the Lord of the Rings trilogy, but we had them in the reverse order. We went 3-2, and we still haven't watched one. We had Pulp Fiction last week, and now we're going to do Reservoir Dogs this week. Would have been nice to do a little, like, what did he learn? But instead, we're going to do how did he digress? And what was the other? Oh, and then we had the Kubrick week where we could have done Strangelove and Space Odyssey, and instead we had to replace both movies. So
yep.
Good times ahead. And next week, John, is the final replacement movie of the podcast. Next week, we are talking about Midnight in Paris, which is replacing Casablanca. The final one, and then the final 16 movies are going to be 32 movies that we both have on our list. So we're almost through the lower seated duplicates, if you will.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Like, we're almost there, and we get to talk about a grand total of like 35 movies, including today, that are just fantastic. So let's keep going.
Yeah, we'll see if John still feels that way. Not this week, but in a couple weeks. You know, I got to keep John on his toes sometimes. And but yeah, so Wild Tales and Reservoir Dogs. Obviously, we're going to start this one off with Wild Tales because Reservoir Dogs is maybe a little bit more popular. I don't know. Have you guys ever heard of Damien Zifron? I don't even actually know how to say his last name. You might have heard of Quentin Tarantino, so we should probably do Reservoir Dogs second. But John, this is your first time watching Wild Tales. I'll give my little intro of why I love this movie so much. But what did you think, being that it was an anthology? And have you watched a lot of anthologies?
I've watched the occasional anthology. It's been a while since I've really indulged in one of them. It's been a while since I've enjoyed one as much as Wild Tales. And I mean, the best way I can sum this up, like, this movie lives up to its name.
Mm-hmm. It does. So, the only other one that I really have enjoyed that I've watched, you know, recently that really comes to mind is Ballad of Buster Scruggs. I really enjoyed Ballad of Buster Scruggs. I know that was kind of like a polarizing movie, but I thought the final story in Ballad of Buster Scruggs I thought was brilliant, even though that was, I think, also the most polarizing of all of them. But I thought that one was absolutely brilliant. But so Wild Tales was an interesting one for me because I don't remember what year it was. I want to say it was like 2016, 2017, something like that. And I was home in New Jersey. And my dad was like, you got to watch this movie. And like, he's somebody who like, he loves The Godfather and he loves, like, you know, old movies. But in terms of new movies, he hated The Banshees of Inisherin and he loves Grown Ups. So it's just gotten to that point of like, all right, like, you've lost it. You like movies from the 70s, you know, death metal only, you know, and like, let's move on. And instead, he said, you got to watch this. And I remember we all sat down and all of us were a little like skeptical because that's just how we have to be. And that first story played and I was like, oh my God, what is this movie? And so we're going to talk about this. And it was funny, John, because I looked at your review before getting into this. And the first time I watched this movie, this was in my top 100. However, I agree with you that it loses its luster as it gets going. The stories after the Ricardo Darin one, the next two have such a hard time living up to what those first four stories put through. However, on this rewatch and on subsequent rewatches, knowing where those stories go, because the fifth one, I think, might be one of the best ones. And on the first watch, it was the one that was like, this is out of place. I don't like it. It doesn't make any sense. Rewatching that one, the escalation and what that is saying about the Argentinian society is so brilliant. But I truly believe that without knowing where it's going, it's very hard to get into because you're coming off of what I personally believe could be the best half hour in film history. Like that Ricardo Darin part for me is next level storytelling, next level filmmaking. Essentially, Cifron, when he made that, it was like he went to a sketch comedy writing class and said, how can we make his day get worse and worse and worse and worse? But it all comes together at the end and it's absolutely brilliant. And then the wedding one, I have such an appreciation for now because it really is a different take on all the other ones kind of end on a negative note, right? Or even the ones that end, like the Ricardo Darin one ends on a positive note in air quotes, but he's still in prison, right?
Yeah.
Then the wedding one is the only one that ends on a positive note. And it is one of the most ridiculous ones in terms of these are like, that's something we can all experience. Road rage in the middle of a desert road isn't something we can all experience, but that is something we can all experience and to see how they act and how it goes, and then ends on a positive note, I think is what's really important to this movie. But the airplane one, the road rage one, and the Ricardo Darin one, I mean, the first time you watch them, it's hard not to be in love with them because they just keep going and going and going and going. But ultimately, what he wanted to make a movie that was about the Argentinian government and how he felt that it was oppressing its people and how he felt that it was keeping its people down. And I don't know the type of government Argentina has, to be honest with you. But it was about how the government was taking advantage of its people and how it was all corruption and how he wanted to show that whether you were poor, rich, middle class in this system, you were going to become a part of the corruption pretty much no matter what. And it was, how can you stand up to that? How can you make the change to overcome that? And rather than try to tell the story, because let's be realistic here, stories four and five, the one about the son hitting the running over the pregnant woman and the one about dynamite, those two could have been feature length films. Those could have been hour and a half, 2 hour feature length films. But to put them amongst these other short stories that are biting and talk about all these different things going on in society, I think it's just brilliant. And it's going to be interesting because obviously there's only so high movies can now go in our list, right? Like we obviously are going to love our top 20. Like there's no doubt about it, but I am curious to see if I enjoy the other movies in my top 100 as much as I enjoyed this one on a rewatch, because I will say that are in my top 20, because I will say that of all of my top 20 films, this is the one I've seen the least. And it just gets better and better every time. And, you know, The Godfather I have next at 17, and I got Cinema Paradiso at 16. Everybody wants them at 15. It's hard for me to imagine me putting this over those movies. But also, this one just hit me again. It's like watching it for the first time again.
Yeah, it's such an experience watching this film, especially myself going in completely blind, not knowing what to expect. When you sit down and this opening sequence with this plane, and it's that slow build of, you know, oh, these two people. It's really funny because I've been watching Lost recently. Mm-hmm. So, you know, planes are kind of triggering at the moment. Mm-hmm. So, but you see these connections on a plane, the way these people are connecting to each other. And then you start realizing everyone has the exact same connection to this one guy. And then, like, the horror kind of strikes you because we're already told ahead of time that this person, the model that we've been following, didn't pay for her flight. She was given the ticket. And it's set up so perfectly. And then there's the realization that no one paid for their flight. It's just wackadoodle. I don't know how else to explain it, right? It escalates so quickly. It goes into this plane crash into what I could only assume are Pasternak's parents in the end.
Those are his parents, of course. His parents, right? They are. And those are his parents.
And it goes straight into the credits after that, and you're just like, what have I just sat down to watch?
And what are the credits? The credits are animals that are either apex predators or the weakest of prey. That's all they are. And that's what this movie's about.
It is, because it's all about that disparity in power and everything. And it's all about these people, these desperate people. And just the way they respond in different situations. And it's so fascinating because it's such a brilliant look at just like the human condition in general. Yeah, it's focused in Argentina, obviously. But I think you're pretty hard-pressed not to relate most of these stories to literally almost anyone on the planet.
So this movie, it must have been 2018 that I watched this for the first time, because I was home in the summer from LA and I'd driven across the country. On the way back, I was driving back to LA with my uncle. And somebody cuts us off in Arizona. I was like, yeah, just let them cut us off. Like, I don't give a damn. Like, they can do whatever they want. Like, what Jaws did for the ocean, this movie did for me on deserted highways. Now, my wife will tell you that I am literally these two guys in the road rage one, because somebody cuts me off in Miami, and you better believe I'm laying on the horn. I'm flipping them off. I'm screaming at the top of my lungs. You know, I do the Louis C.K. joke of you inconvenience me for 3 seconds. I hope you die and your whole family. You know, it's like it just keeps going on and on and on. But that deserted isolation is what makes this one so good, because here's the smooth, suave guy. And I also love how long it takes the redneck to catch up to him, right? Like it's that there's it takes forever for the redneck to catch up to him. But it's so good. And so what I think the brilliance of this movie is that they all have the same theme, right? They all have the same theme of, like you said, desperate people, people who have been overlooked, people who feel that they have no control over their lives. And now they're trying to take control. Every one of them is trying to take control in some way. See that with Pasternak, where his whole life he's been shut down by this person, this person. I was his best friend. You weren't his best friend. You made fun of him all the time and we were terrible to him and blah, blah, blah. And then we see the rat poison one where her family and he doesn't even recognize her. So now she wants to take him out. She can't believe it. So how can she get control of that situation? And it just keeps going and going and going. It's about getting control. It's about, you know, feeling angry and just frustrated in a society that you feel you really don't have a place in, or that they're not giving you a place in. And to make them all varying lengths about completely different things, everything's a reset. And I think also that's what's hard about this movie on the first watch is every time one ends, how often do you, as soon as a movie ends, you sit down and you watch a next movie? You don't do that. Like you don't. Well, but I'm saying in the matter of seconds, like you have to take the DVD out and put the DVD in and see the menu. Or if you're on Netflix, find the movie. Like, this is, it cuts to black. Like, I think about the one where they're covering for Santiago and the gardener goes walking out. He literally gets hit with the thing and it cuts to a picture and it cuts to black. And then immediately a picture of the bride as a child. It's so well done. And it's so hard to keep that momentum up because you're like, okay, what did I just watch? Now I have to go into the next one, but it is endlessly revisitable. And they don't feel like shorts. They're so complete. It's unbelievable because even with the Ballad of Buster Scruggs, right? I mean, you saw Ballad of Buster Scruggs or not?
I have not.
Okay, you haven't. So I won't spoil it, but in Ballad of Buster Scruggs, some of the stories do feel a little artsy for the sake of being artsy. This one doesn't have a single artsy story. Every one of these stories is getting right to the point of, and that's why I said it's almost like a sketch comedy class. these are SNL skits, except 30 minutes long and very dark, even though they're very funny. But it's all about, here's your setup, here's your main plot point, and here's how it's going to spiral, and then it's all going to come together at the end with the button. And every one of these has an epic button, which makes it hard to get into the next one right away.
Yes and no. Like, I feel like there's contrast between them, but because of the thematic similarities, it was pretty easy to follow along. And I feel like the opening of each of them is distinct enough to separate it from what precedes it.
Also so hard to do, but yes, I agree.
Yes, it is. Because a filmmaker wants to get like artsy with that a lot of the time. Like you were saying, right? Where sometimes a filmmaker gets kind of like in on themselves and they want like a more through thread line. And I think the beauty of this movie is the fact that there isn't that through line between them. We don't see the characters from any of them popping up in the other short stories. We don't even get like the ending of one rolling into another or anything like that. It just cut, here's a new one, cut, here's a new one. And in doing that, I think it strengthens the theme it's trying to show.
Because it makes it, again, like poor, rich, doesn't matter where you are in your life in this society, something's against you. Mm-hmm. Something is always against you. Even we see the corrupt father trying to cover for his son and willing to just pay his way out of this to the gardener. And even he starts to be like, why am I dealing with this corruption from the lawyer and the prosecutor? They're all trying to bleed him dry. That's what this is all about, right? Like it's that whole feeling of nothing is mine because everybody wants a piece of it. And I think that's really what he's getting at in this is, you know, the first one, he can't become a musician and he can't become, you know, he wasn't successful because of whoever. And his parents put too much pressure on him. The second one, her family lost everything because of this loan shark gangster, and it made her father kill himself, and he made a move on the mother. In the third one, that one's kind of the one that's a little bit out of place, but I think that just shows like that one's more about the classes in Argentina, which then we get into again in number four. I'm sorry, in number five, but they all kind of dive into that same thing. And I agree. I think it makes it more powerful that he wasn't trying to do what Tarantino does or what somebody else might do in this, right? Because Tarantino, we see it all the time when we talk about Reservoir Dogs, when we talk about Pulp Fiction, and when we talk about Inglourious Basterds. Those are movies where there's all these different storylines going on, but they all converge. They all have that crash moment. They all have that, you know, that bigger thing. This movie just doesn't. And I wonder, like, Ballad of Buster Scruggs was made on Netflix by the Coen brothers. Mm-hmm. I do wonder, and we haven't seen a movie like this made. I don't think a movie like this can get made in America. This movie was a big budget movie for Argentina. Mm-hmm. Argentina/Spain. Spain, I think, put 30% of the money into this because Pedro Almodovar had a big part of this. But I don't think this could get made in America. And I don't think it's necessarily that there's not an audience, especially nowadays with people having the shorter attention spans, wanting shorter movies. Could this work with a six short stories that where the longest one is 30 minutes and you're laughing, you're into it, whatever. And yet we've not seen a theatrical release of an anthology in how long? And a lot of times when they're made four rooms, something like that, they're all terrible.
Yeah. I feel like in North America, it's kind of viewed as like a niche way of going about it. I feel like it's the same approach people take to short stories in general, right? I think like North America has this fascination with novels and just like the novel as a whole and how like you need this longer verbose story all the time. Whereas I mean, personally, like when I was studying English and stuff in university, I love short stories. I find short stories are so much more compelling than a novel because it takes so much to be able to convey a theme well in a short story, because you have to be concise at the same time that you're building things up, and because they are varied length, right? And that's really what this movie's doing. This movie is saying, I don't need a full 2-hour runtime to portray a theme. I can connect these with similar themes, but each segment, whether it be like the 5-minute opening or the half hour one in the middle, it portrays a similar theme, pretty much the same theme, but each are effective at doing it by themselves. You can show any section of this film to someone independently of the rest, and they still understand what it's about. That's the power of them.
I agree. And like, I always laugh when this, so this was nominated for Academy Award for international film. It lost, I forget what, two, but any one of these shorts could have been nominated for best short film at the Academy Award. That's what's incredible about this movie, right? Like any one of these could have been done. And, you know, a lot of filmmakers now, as they're trying to break in, it gets harder to break in because now there's not this independent cinema like a Reservoir Dogs anymore that you can make. But if somebody made a 20-minute short similar to Reservoir Dogs, what, shop that around, entered that into competitions, whatever, and then said, oh, by the way, we have other short stories that go around that one, I wonder if there would be an audience or a market or something like that for it. Because Wild Tales was a huge hit. I think it's the highest grossing Argentinian film of all time, which, what does that mean? I don't know, but Secret in Their Eyes won best foreign film, and that was Argentinian. Mm-hmm. So it was the highest grossing Argentinian film of all time. It was a huge hit at the Cannes Film Festival. I think it won the audience prize, I believe. I could be wrong on that. But this was a very, very, very successful movie worldwide. And it garnered Damien Cifron, or I cannot believe I don't know how to say his name, but I don't think he's done anything since this movie. Mm-hmm. Or if he has, we haven't really heard of it. And I just think that is, you know, kind of like the state of, I think that's kind of like the state of film, international film, that people don't really realize is how hard it is, no matter how much of a hit you have, no matter how much success you have. If you're not Denny, your man, or if you're not, you know, somebody like that, it's really hard to garner a following. It really is. Like, and you see that because this type of movie needs to do well internationally. It's because Argentina just doesn't have as big of a box office as America or China, or, you know, if you collectively talk about Europe, it needs to do well internationally. And yeah, I'm looking right now. He has literally not done a movie since Wild Tales.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's hard too, right? I can only imagine how hard it is to have, I mean, you used to work in film distribution, or like, you know, film distribution and stuff. Like, how hard is it to market an Argentinian film to an American audience?
Very hard. Very. People don't want to read subtitles. They don't. No. And I think that's the shame of it, because so much of like what influences what gets made is what will work in America, right? What will work in China? Mm-hmm. This movie doesn't work in Asia, because there's really no action in this movie, and Asia is all about action. And in Europe, this might work because Europeans might laugh at this, but Europeans, I don't think, have the same frustration that a lot of South American, Central American countries have. Whereas I feel like the reason that this one, and it worked so well in Europe, I'm not saying it didn't, but I think the reason this one also worked so well in North America is because a lot of people do feel these similar frustrations. You know, I mean, I was living in Los Angeles. They have dead fire hydrants out there. So fire hydrants that don't actually do anything. You know what I mean? Like, it's a fire hydrant, but they just haven't removed it yet, is what I'm saying. So there was one on Hartsook Street in North Hollywood, California, that every other fire hydrant in North Hollywood, California was paint, the curb was painted red. This one was not painted red, never was in use. People would park in front of it all the time. No problems, whatever. I parked in front of it one time, ended up getting my car towed. So I call them and I'm like, this is ridiculous. Like, I tried to fight it, whatever. I didn't have a lawyer. I didn't want to go to court, but I was like, this is ridiculous. It wasn't painted red. Oh, well, you should know that you're not supposed to park in front of a fire hydrant, blah, blah. And I'm like, but the fire hydrant on Otsego Street, which is the street next to Hartsook, is painted red. And the one at the other end of Hartsook is painted red. This is ridiculous. Like, it's not painted red. Therefore, you should be able to park. It's not even like the paint was faded or chipped away. There was no paint.
Yeah.
3 days later, it's painted red.
Hmm.
But guess who still had to pay like 700 fucking dollars. Me. So I understand Ricardo Darin's frustration in that one so much. And it's that feeling of we have no control, because you're talking to these people who are working for a government agency, just doing what they're told to collect the paycheck. They don't care. They don't care at all. I love all that stuff about being a fascist and yes, sir. Okay, whatever. Like, I'm going to call security. Like, I don't care. I love that this movie gets into all of that. And I love, though, that it goes there. I always say that with movies, right? Like The Graduate, it goes there. Everybody has that thought. What if you had the hot older woman after college? No. It goes there, though. It doesn't just think about it. Just talk about it. It goes there. And this one, I mean, at the end of Dynamites, when he blows up the car, it's just fascinating. He just hits his – everything that could go wrong goes wrong. And in that moment, he's sitting there at the cafe with Ere Libre playing. And it's brilliant. It's brilliant. And it's just a man at his breaking point, And people, and then you see the news articles about people who are happy about it and whatever. And he says it in the movie, like, everybody is too scared. Everybody gets frustrated by it, but everybody is too scared to actually take a stand. And that's what this movie is, right? This movie is, you're pissed off at the guy driving on the car in the road next to you, but you're too scared to say anything to him. And this one shows what could happen if you do say something to him. With the rat poison, she doesn't care about going to jail. She feels freer in jail than she does living in Argentina. I mean, that is powerful stuff from a character who's maybe on screen for 25 seconds in this whole thing and kills a man with a cleaver.
Well, with a knife, yeah. Yeah, it's so fascinating seeing the lengths that everyone goes in this, especially because like almost all of them end up with death of some sort, except for the one that has a car bomb. No one dies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Yep. And like the fact that no one dies from that is what indicts him in the first place, because he's just an expert with dynamite. So clearly he's the one who knew exactly how much to use so no one would get hurt. Mm-hmm. It's so that juxtaposition between the fact that everything preceding that has had death in it, except for this one that has arguably the most violent act in it.
And it's the one that would make the biggest impact, right? This is the one that's actually reaching a national scale, unlike the others, which are really just very much in their own little thing. The one with the gardener and the cover up, that one is definitely going on to a bigger scene, but that's kind of, there was a murder. I mean, you know, not to play it lightly, but like right now there's those murders going on in Idaho. I don't really know anything about it. There's a lot of people who are following it very, very closely, but the people of Idaho, the people in that town in Idaho are much more involved in that than somebody who lives in South Florida. And if I don't really look into it, I'm not going to know anything about it. However, if somebody went out and blew up a DMV, I would know about that, no matter where that was in America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just goes to show what's more important and what gets the attention. And I think that's also an important part of this film. Mm-hmm. Where, I mean, if we look at that second segment where the waitress's entire family has been essentially killed by this man, and she's fantasizing about the ability to do something about it, but isn't willing to do it herself, and actually does nothing in that entire segment. She does nothing. She, in fact, tries to prevent anything from happening. And it's the cook that does it all, right? Mm-hmm. And it's the cook who has no fear of going to jail because she does feel that she's more free. But, like, that's not the type of thing that gets headlines, right? The end of the third segment, they had the question of some lover's quarrel, right? Mm-hmm. We just watched a man shit on someone's windshield. And the only take that the people responding to the incident is, oh, it must have been some lover's quarrel. Because their bodies were entwined when they went up in flames. And like, I think that was beautiful. That was
so funny.
You have to, when the guy pulls his pants down, you're just like, he's going there.
Yeah.
And you have to respect the man willing to go there, because not many people.
and what I love about that segment is the other guy would have gotten away if he wasn't such an angry, he turns around, he's trying to run the guy over. He would have gotten away. He was driving away.
Yeah. He was fine. He was totally fine. And decided that he had to go back. And it ends with a bang, right? Like another explosion there. And then the one that actually gets the attention is this one that's kind of viewed as that is domestic terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And despite the fact that everything is telegraphed so early in this film that this is what's mm-hmm. going to happen, like that segment opens up with us seeing this guy inspecting dynamite for the demolition of a building.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, he's this expert with dynamite. We should know exactly where this is going. But the thing that this movie does is it takes what you fantasize about, those fantasies that we have about going that next step that are like, you know, our conscience kind of tells us, okay, we can't do that though. We can't mm-hmm. go that far. And this movie says, but what if you did?
Mm-hmm. But what if you can? And what I appreciate about this movie too is a lot of times the people who are making the stand are the people with nothing to lose, right? Yeah. So in part one, it's this guy who literally has just been turned down by everybody. In the second one, it's the cook. In the third one, it's the redneck who's willing to go a little bit more overboard. The other guy's trying to, and he's the one who's hammering the windshield, taking a dump on his car, peeing on his car, all of that. In the fourth one, it's that guy who has lost everything, and he's, you know, he's now lost his job. So it, you know, he had status, now he has none. In the fifth one, it's the gardener who's willing. And in the sixth one, it's the cook again. It's another chef. The cook is the one who is willing to say, forget it, I'll sleep with her. I'll sleep with the bride at this wedding, and I don't care what happens. Like, I love that, like, you know, showing that hierarchy of power. And I think that's ultimately what he was trying to say is, if it doesn't, like, the sometimes the lowest people on the totem pole actually can do the most. It's just unfortunate that often they're the ones who suffer the biggest consequences as a result. And the rich keep on going and doing what they're doing. Dynamite goes to jail. You know, at the end of part two, she goes to jail. Those things happen. And what happens to everybody else? They're going on with their lives. They're continuing on. Even at the end of the marriage one, the cook does whatever he does. And now the marriage is kind of going back to whatever the hell that's going to be. But
well, while we're talking with the last segment, because you already mentioned it earlier, and before we wrap up Wild Tales, I don't think this is a happy ending at all. I think this is like one of the most depressing endings in a movie ever.
See, I think it's a hopeful ending. That's funny you say that, because I feel that this is a hopeful ending. I feel that he took, throughout all of these, they all kind of end on a negative note, right? Even Dynamite, he's in jail.
Yeah.
Like, they all end on a kind of negative note. And this one ends with, look at the disaster we're a part of. And yet human nature takes over, right? Like, that's what that kind of felt like to me. Like, the human race will continue on. These two who just went through the wedding from hell are now going to sleep with each other. They start going at it right in front of every one of their guests. And all the guests leaving is such a funny ending with the one girl clapping. But I feel like it's meant to be like a hopeful, that even throughout all of the disaster, there's still something positive that could come out of things.
See, I kind of view it more like through the lens of like Evangelion, where these two people are just so sad and so alone that they can't not be together.
Mm-hmm. Which is true too. I mean, I think there's a way of how do you want to take that, right? They're so sad and they're so alone, they can't not be together, or they're so sad and they're so alone, at least they have each other, right? Like, you might be stuck in Argentina during, like, however the heck Damien views this, but at least you're not in jail, at least you're not blowing up places, and you guys still have each other. I mean, I think that last one, when you know how it's going to end, is just an absolutely beautiful ending to what is a really, really, really dark movie, despite being unbelievably funny.
And the comedy in this movie cannot be undersold.
No, this might be the funniest dark comedy I've ever seen in my life. Like, I'm not saying it's the funniest movie I've ever seen, but in terms of a dark comedy that just nails it, think about The Music Critic in the first one. What a dick that guy is. You don't still keep in touch with him, do you? No, I don't. Oh God, good, because he was a disaster. Anybody who would turn that in, we made fun of him for weeks. Like, he is such a bad person. And they make sure that every single one of these people in this, like, there's comedy, there's drama, but they're all kind of just who they are, and that adds to the comedic elements of this whole movie.
It does. And one thing I do really want to touch on here is the cinematography in this movie is phenomenal.
It's so gorgeous.
There are just shots where I'm just standing there, like astounded by what I'm seeing on the screen.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it was Javier Ulia or something like that is the cinematographer, and huge props. Like this film is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, one of my favorite shots of the entire thing is at the end of the movie when he pulls the knife. Right when he's they all like, please don't kill her. The disco ball is still going. Mm-hmm. The disco ball is going through that whole scene, and it adds a level of chaos. Even as everybody's kind of motionless now, the doctors are there, everybody's kind of coming to terms with it. That's still spinning to create this uncomfortableness. That's the next level stuff you talk about when you're making a movie, right? Like that's the next level thinking that goes into it that turns a movie into art, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree.
Javier Julia. Let's see if he ever did anything else. You better believe nothing we've ever seen.
I would imagine they are Argentinian films.
Yeah, a lot of shorts and TV shows in Argentina. So, but overall, John, good viewing of this movie. Is this a movie you watch with other people?
I would watch this. I watch this, and it's the type of movie you want to share with other people.
It is. Yeah, that's how I feel too. I feel like this is, out of all the movies in my top 100, this is probably the one where I'd say. Because like Gladiator and stuff, people have watched. Mm-hmm. Lord of the Rings, people have watched. But this is the one where it's like, if you haven't seen one, watch this one. Just watch this one. Don't go watch Barcelona and don't go watch, you know, something super depressing. But go watch Wild Tales and let me know what you think.
Yeah.
We're going to turn it into a hit, John. Even though it already kind of is. But anyway, what was the best thing you watched this week? Or these last 2 weeks? It's been a while.
So like since we last counted down, I have watched 25 films. Since we last talked about number 19. You know, had some holidays.
That's how people normally spend 2 weeks, John.
Of course, right? Just watching films. I watched 5 films on Wednesday.
Nice. And
2 of them were Avatars, so it was a very medium day.
Not nice.
And like I kind of talked about some of the stuff. Like some of the things I watched were things that are already in my top 100. Obviously, like Christmas happened, so I watched It's Wonderful Life again. Mm-hmm. I got around to watching things that'll probably end up in my top 100 with that we talked about last week with like The Graduate and Everything Everywhere All at Once again. I think aside from those, the movie that I watched that was probably best was probably Kicking and Screaming.
There you go, John. You're back. 90s John is here to stay. Now you got to watch the whole Whit Stillman trilogy again and tell me if you were wrong.
Yeah, probably. I have to get around to it again. I don't know, though. Like, it's still a lot. I'm still really worried. But, no, Kicking and Screaming was great. It was – I really do enjoy Noah Baumbach and his style. But I texted you as soon as I started watching it. I'm like, this feels like a Whit Stillman movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was – I always say this on this podcast, but 90s – indie films, like the ones where like the no budget 90s movies, give me those over the no budget nowadays movies. I don't give a crap how good your movie looks. I'd rather blatantly know that they're not at a graduation party or whatever the hell Kicking and Screaming was to start at. I'd rather watch that though than watch, you know, oh, that looks beautiful and the main character hasn't spoken for 45 minutes because he's sad. Oh no, that's his defining trait, is that he's sad. Like, give me this every time. I love the dialogue. I love the banter. They're so entertaining. It's such a great movie. And it has Chris Eigenman. So it's a winner.
Yeah, of course.
And Otis in that movie is so freaking funny. But anyway.
Yes. What was your best watch in these last 2 weeks?
So I'm gonna kind of do what you did, where it's like I had a couple really good ones in here. So I finally got around. So for Christmas, I got a whole bunch of Criterion movies that my family got for me. I watched A Man Escaped. That was my first Robert Bresson movie. I thought that was a really good movie. A lot of voiceover, which kind of drove me nuts, but really good other than that. Memories of a Murder, I finally got around to. I've had that here forever and just haven't watched it. That's the Bong Joon-ho movie. There we go. Got it. That's his movie from 2003. That was really good, but 3.5 stars. Finally got around to Everything Everywhere All at Once. That movie was really entertaining. It lost me a bit in the second part. Towards the end, I thought the second part went on a little too long with all the revelations about how to be nice to each other or whatever. But what a whacked movie. Hot Dog Fingers was absolutely hilarious. I talked a lot about Babylon and how much I loved Babylon. I thought Babylon was fantastic. I think it's getting shit on because people are sad that they're not Damien Chazelle. A lot of people who are really, really upset that they'll never be as successful as him, writing really angry reviews towards him. Doesn't mean you can't not like his movie, but there was a review that I read that Steve had sent to me that said he had never put a memorable shot on film in any movie he's ever made. And I was like, how that person has so many followers.
Wait,
yeah. That person has so many followers on Letterboxd. And I'm like, how can people actually like that critic and take them seriously when they make a statement as wrong as that statement? You can hate Damien Chazelle, but to say he has never put a memorable shot on film makes you an ignoramus. Anyway, but the best, I'm going to go with Kiss Me Deadly from 1955. Okay. It's a film noir, like that's a pulp movie based on a pulp novel by Mickey Spillane. And it gets into like atomic fears and stuff. Freaking entertaining. But it, you know, it's one of those old school, like how did, like they show the guy chained up and then, you know, they show like his plan through his eyes. And then they cut to a room outside, they cut back in and the other guy's unconscious and like the guy's now escaped. Like it's one of those where a little suspension of disbelief, but I think that's what adds to it because it's just so damn pulpy. Yeah, it's Kiss Me Deadly from 1955. Very, very, very entertaining movie.
Sounds like it. I'm going to have to give it a watch.
Yeah, you'll enjoy it, I think. But tell us all about why you have Reservoir Dogs, the worst Quentin Tarantino movie. Just kidding. I'm just kidding. I'm just saying that to mess with you.
Whoa.
The worst Quentin Tarantino movie as your favorite Quentin Tarantino movie.
Well, I mean, you just said it when we were talking about Kicking and Screaming, that you love low-budget 90s movies, and Reservoir Dogs is kind of like the epitome of those.
It is.
It's the one that really got all of that more mainstream, right? Because why I like this one more is it's so conversation-based. I feel like this is – Tarantino has made better movies since Reservoir Dogs came out, but they kind of lose some of what makes Tarantino Tarantino. And Reservoir Dogs is just pure Tarantino. It is all conversation the entire time. There's almost no action in this entire movie, and the action we get is a couple of gunshots. Uh-huh. And that's it. Everything is told to us. Tarantino perfectly lays out everything that happens, and we slowly piece it together throughout the film as we're revealed more truths of everything that was going on. The opening line to this movie is, it's a metaphor for big dicks.
Mm-hmm.
And like right then and there, you are full on Tarantino. You know exactly what's happening. And this opening conversation about it's a virgin and tipping and everything. First off, Tarantino spoils the entire film in that scene. And it's just this masterclass in conversation. That's just what this film is. It held this legacy where I was misinformed that my father watched it every Christmas Eve. I have learned since then that is not the truth. Mm-hmm. And I had just like made my own cultural zeitgeist about this film, but I've fallen in love with it since then. And it's just one of those ones where it's 90 minutes, I can throw it on and just like enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny to sit back and watch old Tarantino and then watch new Tarantino. Like, mm-hmm. Okay. So Inglourious Basterds in my top 100, I had Once Upon a Time in Hollywood in my top 100. Mm-hmm. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I've since said will drop out. And like, you know, I still a phenomenal 4-star, you know, if it's not in my top 100, it's in my top 150. It's right there. Yeah. Right. But I think what's so fascinating to sit down and watch Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction in back-to-back weeks like we just mm-hmm. did is you really see Tarantino doing what Tarantino was born to do. Because while his other movies, Kill Bill, you know, I love both Kill Bills. I love mm-hmm. Inglourious Basterds. I just said Django, I think, is good. I don't love Django like a lot of people do, but this was what he was born to do. He was born to make these fake gangster movies. He really was. And man, like Reservoir Dogs, you can sit there now and roll your eyes at the guys who walk around with the shirts on, with the guys with the ties and all of that.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it is so iconic and it absolutely earned that right. And, you know, we talked about last or 2 weeks ago now with Pulp Fiction, how people just rip it off like crazy. Reservoir Dogs might be more ripped off than Pulp Fiction was. Any heist movie that followed Reservoir Dogs wanted to do what Reservoir Dogs did, and it couldn't do it. I mean, Reservoir Dogs really changed the heist movie game.
Yeah.
And it turned it into something different. It didn't need the monster heist scene. There is no heist scene in this movie.
No, there's not. And instead, what we get, we have the preamble in the restaurant, and then we cut to Mr. Orange's shop. And we're like, okay, everything went bad. And then we're, like I said, we're piecing together this film with what's being told. We have the conversation between Mr. White and Mr. Pink. And that's like our first truth that we are told. We are told the truth based on this conversation, and they're constantly correcting each other. We are, we as an audience are being told we can't trust any of these narrators, but they're all telling us some parts of the truth, and we can kind of piece it together. And where do we go from there?
Yeah. And what story do we think is the right story, right? Like, as we're sitting there watching this movie, we're being left to try to piece it together as well. And I think that's part of the fun of it, because just from that Harvey Keitel, Steve Buscemi scene right off the bat, we don't know which one of them is telling, no, trust me, this is what happened. No, that's what happened. And that argument, no, first the cop started shooting, then Mr. Blonde started shooting. No. Mr. Blonde started shooting, then the cops showed up. The cops were already there. Like, it's that type of dialogue. And I think people who tried to emulate Tarantino, I think missed what Tarantino really was good at, which was just creating tension and moving plot along without just being exposition-y, right? Because a lot of the stuff that tried to mimic Tarantino just turned out to be exposition-y, or the conversations were boring as hell and actually didn't mean anything. They were 5-minute long conversations that didn't go anywhere. But Tarantino, that scene between Buscemi and Keitel is almost 6-7 minutes long. Yeah. And it's just the two of them having a conversation about what went wrong. What are they going to do with Orange? Have you heard from Nice Guy Eddie? Have you heard from Joe? What's going on? Are the cops going to come here? Where's Mr. Blonde? Mr. Brown is dead. We know all that. But it's also getting at the heart of, okay, Buscemi is saying, I hid the gems. I hid the diamonds. Do we trust him that he hid the diamonds? Does Harvey Keitel trust him? Was there an informant? Could one of them be the informant? Who are they actually after? What were they trying to pull? Those are all of the fun things that go into this. And the characterization of Mr. Blonde, because of that dialogue, is so incredible. And what makes it all the more terrifying when he actually does come into the movie, when Michael Madsen's best performance by far, oh, not that the guy's had that many good performances, but this is an iconic, iconic performance by Michael Madsen in this.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is like Tarantino introduces all of these characters to us in a way where we really understand who they are with that diner scene. Mm-hmm. And from there, we get those buildups in them. We get the flashback for Mr. White. We get the flashback for Mr. Blonde and Mr. Orange. But, I mean, the character everyone remembers from this movie is still Mr. Pink, right?
Yeah.
Which is, it's wild to think about the fact that the character who's in the entire movie, he's one of the only characters in the entire film, but who doesn't get a flashback, is the one that everyone's more iconically remembers. He's the squirrely guy who just doesn't trust anyone. And Steve Buscemi plays him perfectly.
Well, and this was Steve Buscemi's coming out party, right? I mean, this was, if I'm not mistaken, I think this was really the first Buscemi role that anybody knew about. Let me see here, movies. Because I think Buscemi, up until this point, like Fargo obviously really put him on the map, because, you know, Fargo was just like, you know, he plays such a great villain in that movie. But up until this movie, he'd been in TV shows. He was in Barton Fink as Chet, but he's barely in that. He, you know, he did some Coen Brothers stuff, but it wasn't anything crazy. This was really his big break. And I think it's funny now when we turn around and we watch this movie back to see Steve Buscemi in such a small role, right? Not a small role, but in such a side role to people like Tim Roth and Harvey Keitel, who I don't think are nearly as much of household names as Steve Buscemi. Buscemi is probably, out of everybody in this movie, probably the most famous in the grand scheme of things. I mean, he had his own show on Boardwalk Empire on HBO. Yeah. I mean, that was massive. Buscemi's been all over. And I think Keitel was kind of always like the, you know, it was viewed as Scorsese's B team. And mm-hmm. Michael Madsen was a B movie guy. And Tim Roth only really became known because of Quentin Tarantino. Yeah. I really think like that helps elevate this movie now 30 years later, because Steve Buscemi did end up becoming such a big name. And because of the role he's in, that's the role he plays. And even when he's Nucky Thompson in Boardwalk Empire, even though he's the kingpin in that, he still has the energy of Mr. Pink.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's just iconic. And just the no tipping. Okay. Let's just dive into the diner scene. Cause, like I said, it kind of explains everything, right? No tipping. He's the stingy one who wants to hold his money back. So of course he's the one who's squirreling away the diamonds and making sure that the diamonds still happen. Then one of the most brilliant parts of that scene is Quentin Tarantino's talking about things that no one really else wants to talk about, because Tarantino likes talking about those things. And we never have to see him again after that. Mm-hmm. We get one scene and he gets shot in the head. That's Tarantino for the entire movie. And then you have when Big Joe comes back and asks who didn't tip, who tells him?
It's Tim Roth.
Mr. Orange. It's Mr. Orange.
Yep.
Mr. Orange is ratting out Mr. Pink right away. Mm-hmm. He's clearly the rat. We clearly should know this right from the beginning of the movie. Tarantino tells us this in the opening scene, but you still don't find it out until he shoots Mr. Blonde. Because you just think he's the young guy here who just happened to like be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Also, like him getting shot in the stomach, you think it's because of the cops, and it's because of this botched like carjacking. It's Tarantino just plays with our expectations, and he throws them all out, and just has this master story because of it.
And that's what makes it all the better, right? Because the whole movie, we're sitting there thinking, okay, so it can't be him because the cops shot him. So if he called in the cops wouldn't shoot him unless things went really wrong. But like they said, no. Like he took a bullet. And you're like, okay, he got shot by the cops, so it's not him. And when you do get that reveal that it was just during the carjacking that he got shot in the stomach by, you know, he was so unsuspecting. He just opens the door and the woman shoots him in the stomach. That is such a great subversion. It's like, oh, it wasn't the cops. And at this point, we already know that he is the rat. But still, that's such a great subversion of expectations. And it's not where you think it's going to go, because this whole time you just think, okay, it was a shoot 'em up kind of thing. They were getting away. They were getting away scot-free. And really, as bad as the robbery went, it still went to Mr. Orange's liking. It didn't really ruin Mr. Orange. Mr. Orange got screwed outside of it when they were already on the run after Mr. Brown got shot in the head, which he didn't care that Mr. Brown got shot in the head.
No, and this should have gone off pretty much without a hitch. We don't really know what happens to Mr. Blue. He's just dead. And we see Mr. Brown get shot, but there is no reason why everyone else here shouldn't get out scot-free, except for the fact that Mr. Orange probably, we know the cops know where they need to go, and they're just waiting for Joe to show up. But it's just the fact that we have this idea of how this goes down, and then we actually see it go, like, we don't even see the robbery go down. And again, probably a budgetary restraint for Tarantino, but this brilliant decision nonetheless to never show it.
Yeah, and I think it was because, I mean, you know, he was unknown at the time. And, you know, was it Harvey Keitel was the one who got a hold of this script and said, we got to find a way to make this. And they didn't have the budget. I mean, even I always laugh at the part where the cops are chasing Mr. Pink down the street. You and me could go shoot that exactly the same way today. But again, going back to why I love these 90s movies, there was character to these. There was something that set these apart. Nowadays, everything is how good can it look? How pristine can it be? And that's fine. I'm not knocking HD. I'm just saying I'd rather watch cops fake running going, get out of the way, as they're half-assedly waving their guns than make sure you know, they're robotically doing everything they should be doing, but there's no substance to it. Give me the substance. You know, that's why for me, like, this movie will be timeless, like a 50s and 60s and 70s movie, because it's not about how good does it look, right? You just talked about how you saw the last, you watched the two Avatars on Wednesday. Those movies, it's all about look. It's not about the substance. And eventually the look is going to go away unless you're somehow brilliant like Stanley Kubrick was with 2001 A Space Odyssey. Like, it's going to go away eventually. Even Alien, it goes away. And you can tell half of it's a painting or whatever it is. But it works because what they were doing fits. And Reservoir Dogs, it's not like you're sitting there saying, oh, those cops aren't even good actors. That's not the point of the movie. So you're not bothered by it. Whereas if you sit down and watch Avatar and it doesn't look good anymore, it's, oh, this doesn't look as good as I remember. That was the point of the movie. So that's where Reservoir Dogs, I think, stands. It will stand the test of time better than Inglourious Basterds, than Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, than Django Unchained, because it just, it's allowed to be that gritty early 90s indie movie. And because it was Tarantino's first, it's always going to get that free pass, check off. It's okay that certain things don't look great in this, because at the end of the day, the dialogue, the story, and the characters are what matter. And it's fun to watch a bunch of people rolling around in like in bags of red food dye. Like, it's amazing to watch that happen, because that's just what they're doing. Quentin Tarantino driving the car with the bullet hole in his head is the funniest thing in this movie. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing is, like, this movie's timeless because there's very little things in this film that date this film. Mm-hmm. There's Eddie's cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the fact that tip for this meal is like $8.
Is everybody has to throw in $1. That's the best.
No, those are the two things that date this movie completely. And I think a lot of that comes down from the fact that Tarantino decided to use a 70s soundtrack for the film too.
Mm-hmm.
And he prefaces all of the diegetic music in the film by mentioning that there's this radio station doing a 70s flashback.
Mm-hmm.
And it lets him play with the music so well. And it gives us this, you know, this iconic Steelers wheel scene.
Yeah.
Which is just so character defining. It, like, everything we know about Blonde tells us this guy shouldn't be alone with this cop. We have characters telling us this guy shouldn't be alone with the cop. And then we see what he does, and we're still not prepared for it.
Yeah. Well, and what's interesting, though, is the decision to have the background on Mr. Blonde and show how close he is and he did his time and he's not a rat and he's messing mm-hmm. around. You do see that. Okay, now we've heard that he's a psychopath, but we're seeing in this moment that he's really not that bad. He gets along really well with nice guy Eddie and Joe. So what's going on here with this guy? And when he says, I'm going to torture you and there's nothing you can do about it, he just starts taping his mouth shut. Like, that is the scene that made Quentin Tarantino. That is the scene. That is the defining moment of Quentin Tarantino's career. Without that scene, Quentin Tarantino's career is not what it becomes. But that scene was so shocking and so unbelievably well done, from the music to the performance to what was actually taking place. It is just out of control. The way he chose to shoot that, right? He shows mm-hmm. Michael Madsen walking over. He turns the camera to the side and we just see Madsen come over with the ear in his hand. It's so well done because we can imagine, we're using our imaginations to think about how sick and demented what is happening on screen is, because we know what a sick person he is. And when Madsen walks out and goes and picks up the gasoline so coolly and turns around and just walks back in and starts dumb. It's that type of characterization. That is what made Tarantino. That's what, you know, he's Vic Vega. Well, Vincent Vega's in Pulp Fiction. Are they brothers? That's the rumor, right? How Tarantino has his little universe going on. But even if they're not, even if we just disregard that, that type of character what Vic Vega is and what Vincent Vega are. That suave, off-kilter, kind of mobster, loser guy is what made Quentin Tarantino. And he writes a lot of great characters. I mean, Christoph Waltz's character in Inglourious Basterds, one of the best ever written for film. But these are so natural to what Tarantino was doing. And he really redefined this gangster heist genre with this movie and with Pulp Fiction, even though Pulp Fiction is not a heist movie, but he redefined those genres and made them into what people really recognize as the genre, even though there were 60 years of film similar to this that have nothing to do with Quentin Tarantino.
Well, especially with the gangster movie, right? Like, this is 2 years after Goodfellas.
Yeah.
Like this isn't something new. This is a film that's been being made since the beginning of time and arguably one of the best in the genre had just come out. And Tarantino's just like, I'm going to completely redefine it. I'm going to make it. And like, there's a reason Tarantino became so popular off of this film and Pulp Fiction. They are just transcendent films.
Yeah. Now, do you think, because I was talking about this, independent film is not doing well right now. You know, like a lot of these, like A24 picks them up, but like A24 is an independent film distributor. There's no denying that. Yes, but also A24 has gotten to the point where they're just the new Weinstein company with nicer people running it. That's really all it is. And you know, so that's been around. It's those other indie movies, right, that we're having a harder time getting a hold of, like an After Sun. Well, After Sun was A24. It's A24. But where can the genre go? Because as indie films are not doing well, they're not playing well in theaters, they're not making money. After Sun didn't make anything, right, from what I know. Like Babylon, which was an $80 million budget, coming off of Damien Chazelle, though, who got his start with the indie film Whiplash, indie films aren't doing well. And we get all these blockbusters. I think it's why we're starting to see more blockbusters get nominated for Best Picture, like Black Panther, and Avatar 2 is probably going to get one. And we saw Avatar back in 2009. But when we're seeing all of this, do you think that anybody will ever be able to go back to just making a Reservoir Dogs type movie? Because from what I'm seeing in newer school indie movies is they're trying to have like some really heady message, right? They're trying to be so so impactful on society. Reservoir Dogs wasn't giving a shit about that. Reservoir Dogs was just making a fun movie. How do we get back to them attempting to make a movie like Reservoir Dogs again?
I think there are a lot of people who attempt to make a movie like Reservoir Dogs. I think a lot of people try to. And I just don't think we have someone with the ability of Tarantino trying to. And I think they get distracted. I think people get really distracted and they try to make their dialogue too witty to be that Tarantino-esque or to even like, you know, be like Whit Stillman or Noah Baumbach or any of like those like 90s indie directors, right? They want that witticism to them. And I think they're forcing it. And what we need someone who is just naturally witty writing these, but we also need someone who has a vision for what the whole story is, but isn't distracted by the vision of the film too, right? Because I think that's what we're running into, like you said, where they're trying to make things very artistic and they're focusing a lot on like these beautiful shots and stuff. And they're gorgeous. Like there's some gorgeous movies that come out every year and they have witty dialogue, but not to the extent of these 90s independent films. And I think what it comes down to is I actually almost feel like we need more blockbusters coming out to like balance it out. I think it's weird. And I think like with like the world we've lived in for the last few years, people were anticipating these blockbusters and everything, but they were all put on hold. I think now that they're being released and they're being released quite quickly again and like in quick succession, I think once we get inundated with blockbusters again, people are going to start looking for the independent films.
I think that's true.
Because for the last 3 years, all we've had are the independent films.
Yeah, that's true. Because I feel like a lot of times too, like you see it now with Avatar 2, like people are tweeting about it a lot and talking about it a lot. And I think like I think, you know, as much as you hated that movie, and I haven't seen it yet.
I hated that movie, guys.
As much as you hated it, it is probably good for film that people are talking about something that's not a Marvel movie, right?
Yeah, but absolutely.
How do you get that conversation going around a small – because the thing that's unbelievable about Quentin Tarantino is Quentin Tarantino – when was the first movie that Quentin Tarantino worked with an actual, like, big studio on? Because he was Miramax, right? Did he ever have one?
I think all of his movies are Miramax films. Pretty sure they're all Miramax.
What was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? Because Miramax had dissolved by then. That was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was post Harvey Weinstein. So that was Columbia Pictures.
Yeah.
Okay, so but all of that is to say, Tarantino made his career in indie.
Yeah.
The Weinsteins made their career in indie. A lot of people had a lot of great successes in indie in the 90s. And then it bled over into the 2000s. And there's been some good ones in the 2010s. Like, don't get me wrong. I mean, we had a movie like Room, which was great. That was an indie movie. We, you know, and A24 puts out good movies every year. I mean, we've talked about with Robert Eggers and why can I not think of the other guy's name? Hereditary. Ari Aster. Like, when you start looking at directors like this, it's there. But how do they get into, like, the blood of people the way that Tarantino did? Because Tarantino went Reservoir Dogs, and then he went Pulp Fiction. And Pulp Fiction, obviously, is iconic, but Pulp Fiction wasn't released by a major studio. So how did he go from one to the other and continue to be such a household name as he continued to make what were more indie movies? That's what I'm trying to figure out as I watch this.
Yeah.
Is there still a market for something like Reservoir Dogs? Is there a market for something like Quentin Tarantino, but 90s Quentin Tarantino? Not the Quentin Tarantino that did Once Upon a Time in Hollywood or Hateful Eight or something like that, but 90s Tarantino. If somebody sat down and made – and I'm not talking about like a Winter's Bone, because Winter's Bone is not a fun movie. Winter's Bone is a dark movie, and a movie like Blue Ruin is kind of dark and it doesn't get there. God, what was it? There was a movie about a fishing town with two sisters who commit a murder. I forget what that was called. I got to look it up because it was a good one. But it didn't really do well. It had June Squibb in it. It didn't really do well from a financial standpoint. Is there something for this type of movie still? Or are we always going to look back and say, man, why don't they make movies like Reservoir Dogs anymore when people want to? Like, I'm only 30 years old. I would make a movie. I would love to make a movie like Reservoir Dogs, but is there something still there for a movie like Reservoir Dogs?
I think the other question is, like, with streaming services now, you would think there's more room for indie, but the way streaming services work, the indie movies kind of get lost in the shuffle a lot.
Mm-hmm, they do. Cause they're not, they don't care if they lose money on those.
No. We've seen the way Netflix handles TV shows, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they don't care if they lose money ever.
Yeah.
So why would they take a gamble on this, like, small independent film? I think what we need is a streaming service who's more dedicated to those indie films. And I think we're starting to get those. And especially, like, with those ones moving to, like, the free model, which is a little awkward because, like, you have commercials during your movies and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But like, things like Tubi and stuff do have, like, a large A24 catalog, and I think that helps, but people aren't using them because they're with these big name streaming services, right?
Yeah. And yeah, people are getting tired of paying for so many streaming services.
Well, yes, because it's just cable now.
Yeah, except it's more expensive at this point, and
yeah,
it stops working way more often. Although if you have Xfinity in America, that doesn't work ever. The movie was Blow the Man Down from 2019. If you haven't seen it, directed by Danielle Crudy and I'm looking now, Bridget Savage Cole. Neither one of them have done anything other than that. They wrote and directed it. That's the only movie they've done. It came out in 2020, but it's got June Squibb's in it, Margot Martindale's in it, Morgan Saylor, who plays the daughter in Homeland, is in it. It's a, you know, small town murder movie. It's fun, though. It's a fishing village in New England. It's a lot of fun, but it's still not fun to level of Reservoir Dogs. And people didn't really watch it. People didn't really see it. Mm-hmm. So I just sit here and I wonder, how do you find that audience again? Is there an audience again? A movie like Babylon should have been a low budget movie. It is a financial disaster. Mm-hmm. It's a financial disaster. But why couldn't they find a Babylon for $10 million instead of $80 million? Like, why doesn't that exist?
Right. I don't know. I mean, is like, I think a lot of the thing is also that like A24 crowd is a thing. And like, we have these very pretentious people who really like only A24 movies now. Mm-hmm. And like, we're seeing a divide in our movie viewing audience. And one of the things is we need one of those indie films to be more transcendent and easily accessible. And while they're trying to be these high artsy type films, they're not as accessible as something like a Pulp Fiction.
Well, I think the closest we've probably gotten is Taylor Sheridan. That would probably be, I'd probably say Taylor Sheridan's the closest with doing Sicario and Wind River mm-hmm. and Hell or High Water. And now going over to TV, which wasn't a thing Tarantino could have done back in 1992. Yeah. Going over to TV and doing Yellowstone. Like, I think Taylor Sheridan's probably the closest we have to that because his movies are very, 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 like, specific, yeah. well done. Like, you know what you're watching when you sit down to watch a Taylor Sheridan movie. Mm-hmm. And I think most of his movies are A24, if I'm not mistaken.
Probably. I think a lot of the thing is, like, there's been a lot of discussion of, like, the death of the movie star lately.
Mm-hmm.
And the focus on character. And I think the thing is like, it's harder to focus on a character in an indie film as like this, like big thing to promote the film. Right. Because the indie films, it's featuring the everyman. And some people don't like that because that's not why they're watching films. So it's really hard to promote that way. Not that indie films have like big names attached to them anyways, but there's no thrill of there not being a big name attached to it when it doesn't matter if a big name's attached to a movie anymore.
Yeah, that's true too. I mean, you have to think like, but if you think about Reservoir Dogs, right? Harvey Keitel,
mm-hmm.
you know, he was a big name in the '70s. He wasn't a big name yep. in 1992. Nobody yep. cared that, you know, yep. and I mean, Chris Penn was not really a name and nobody in this movie was really a name. And, mm-hmm. and I don't know. I'm just, this movie really, when I sat down and watched this, especially watching on the heels of Pulp Fiction, I was just like, man, we take Tarantino for granted. People wanted to mimic Tarantino for so long. Now people kind of shy away from being like Tarantino because, like, you know, now it's almost frowned upon because he uses racial slurs too much or something. Like, it's just, it's always something with Tarantino now. But I just think like, as we watch indie films falter, I think a lot of it just comes down to what are you actually putting in that indie film? The ones that do well, Robert Eggers and Ari Aster and Everything Everywhere All at Once. I mean, those are indie movies that the theme, the message of those movies is very much like, or the story of those movies isn't necessarily diving into the problems of society now.
Yeah. They're small stories. Think,
what was that?
They're small stories, the big thing.
Yes. Which I think is what indie kind of needs to do. Because if you're trying to make everything like Moonlight, you're mm-hmm. going to bore people to tears. And that's not saying Moonlight's yeah. boring. That's saying you're not going to be able to make – you're not going to have Barry Jenkins on the behind the camera
yeah.
every time you sit down to try to make a Moonlight. So don't make a Moonlight every time. Where are these fun, independent crime movies now? Like, where are these? And should they come back? Or is this yeah. all a conspiracy to make sure indie movies don't get made so Disney can take over the world, John?
No, A24 still exists. It's fine.
Hey, for now, right? Something bad's yeah. got to happen with A24 at some point, right?
I don't want to hear that.
I'm just saying. But no, I mean, it's true. But then you even look at A24, though, for all of their monster hits, you have movies that when you finish saving the world, huh?
Yeah.
Directed by Jesse Eisenberg.
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? Is like we still have these small movies coming out, and again, it's the I think it's the competing with the streaming services is the big thing.
Mm-hmm.
I really think that's the thing that's really hindering big and like good independent films to breaking into the cultural zeitgeist.
Well, you have a fan in us. If anybody wants to go out and make yes. another Reservoir Dogs, if you want to run around Los Angeles and make a movie with your friends and Uncle Harvey, meaning Keitel, not Weinstein. go ahead and get out there and make and make that movie, because watching Reservoir Dogs, like I had told you, John, I thought Reservoir Dogs was Quentin Tarantino's most overrated movie. It's probably his third or fourth best movie. So here I am saying it's his most overrated movie. And in reality, I think that it's Pulp Fiction, Inglourious Bastards, and then it's either this or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I think we kind of got into the point where that seems to be the consensus Tarantino top four. Just depends what order you have them in.
I think too, the Kill Bills have a cult following. That's the thing. Like, the Kill Bills are super entertaining, but if you're a samurai movie fan, like the Kill Bills are where you're at. Like, you love that stuff. But you had Jackie Brown, didn't you?
I did have Jackie Brown.
Yeah.
And I will say, Hateful Eight, very underrated.
I love the Hateful Eight. I think the Hateful Eight is one of the most overhated movies ever for no reason.
100%.
That movie is so good. It's just long. But you all just sat through 3 hours and 9 minutes of blue people having sex. What are you talking about?
Yes.
Was that the Smurfs or Avatar, John? Which movie am I talking about?
Who knows?
Who knows?
I know next time.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, that got us a little sidetracked. But Reservoir, again, I feel like we get sidetracked when we talk about the movies that have been talked about to death. What are we going to say that's new about Reservoir Dogs, right? Other than that, the line of, if they hadn't done what I told them not to do, they wouldn't be dead. That is one of the funniest lines ever. Yeah. And you know Harvey Keitel was clapping for Michael Madsen at that part, because that probably took Michael Madsen about 25 tries to say.
Yep.
That is such a great line, though. Anyway, it's crazy that Michael Madsen didn't become cooler in movies than what he is in this, but I digress.
Yep.
Top 17 coming up next week, right?
Yeah, that's right. Except we had to replace mine because I, like a dummy, had Casablanca at 17.
But where are you going to end up with Casablanca, do you think?
Casablanca will be number one on my new list.
Is it really?
It is.
Wow. So Casablanca is going to replace Stalker.
It is.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And John had it at 17. What an idiot.
What an idiot I am.
Well, it's funny, you know, again, John, though, we've ruined some great episodes of Movie Buff Specialists. We really have, because we could have done Dr. Strangelove in 2001 together. And now we could have done Casablanca and The Godfather together.
I know.
Generally, an American film before, you know, if you don't really look at BFI, if you look at AFI and things like that, generally considered the second and third greatest film in American history behind Citizen Kane. We could have had that podcast, but John, I guess
this isn't on me. This is on you. This is all on you.
Yeah, that's true. It's actually my fault. But so we're going to be talking about Midnight in Paris instead, which John is using as his replacement for Casablanca, the 2011 Woody Allen movie. And I have The Godfather from 1972 at my number 17. John had that one on his list too a couple of weeks ago. We would have talked probably about 15 weeks ago or so now. So those are the two movies for next week. So make sure to tune in for that. We're getting down into the nitty gritty. And like we said, next week is actually the last time that we are talking about a movie not in either of our top 100. So make sure to tune in for that. Thank you all for listening. If you haven't checked out our 2022 year in review, go check that out. It was a lot of fun to podcast that, even though now we're both just going to start watching movies from 2022 that we hadn't gotten around to that will probably move into our top five. Although I don't know if Everything Everywhere All at Once would have. I think it might have just knocked out Top Gun Maverick for that fifth spot, but it was close either way.
I can tell you Top Gun Maverick didn't crack mine.
Yes, that is true too. So there you go, everybody. So go check out that episode if you haven't checked it out yet. Otherwise, thank you all for listening, and we will be back next week talking about The Godfather and Midnight in Paris.